The following Dharma talk was recorded in June 2015 in St. Louis, Missouri, from the retreat called Awakening Joy, taught by James Barris. The retreat was sponsored by Mid-America Dharma. If you like this recording, you can find more talks at www.midamericadharma.org. For questions, we welcome your emails sent to info@midamericadharma.org. James Barris is a founding teacher of Spirit Rock Meditation Center in California. His popular online course, Awakening Joy, was featured in O Magazine and published as a book in 2012. James's website is www.awakeningjoy.info.
I'm on. What an announcement. Yeah. Hi. So nice to be here with you. And the railroad, yeah. Well, it's been quite a while since I've been here to St. Louis, and actually I was here at this very center. Phil was reminding me about 20 years ago. So when Bridget asked if I'd come, I thought it was probably time. And I first want to extend great gratitude to Bridget, who's done so much work. She is impeccable, and she is, as we were just talking a few minutes ago, as I know, just coming from a place of wanting to share this practice with everyone out of gratitude for what it's done to her. And she's just such a generous heart. It's been really a pleasure working with you, Bridget. Thank you. And she now, as many of you who are part of Mid-America, the organization, know, but many perhaps aren't familiar with Mid-America, Bridget has been part of this community for many years and now lives in Springfield, Illinois. She moved there a year ago. And so this is just coming home as a way to give an offering back to the community, just out of her her generous heart. And just think, out of that invitation and that energy, we all come together and practice together and support each other in being more conscious. So I've been really encouraging her to take in the good merit and the good feeling of what she helped create. And I also want to thank all the people who were the support team, including Diane and Amy and others that were mentioned. It's really so wonderful to know that there's a community, a strong community here that just wants to put on retreats like this. Retreats like this out of their own appreciation for the practice. I just come and show up, and here's all of you. How cool that is. And it feels really good to be here. There are varying degrees of experience in this room. There's some people who've been practicing a long time, and have done many retreats. There are some people who are brand new to the practice, and everybody belongs. It's going to be a chance for us all to support each other. For those who've been practicing for some time, then you already know the power of the practice and probably have been touched by it. And in a weekend like this, you are remembering, reminding yourself and accessing that place of connection that you've touched before. For those who are brand new to the practice, I'm so happy that I can be someone who introduces you to it. Out of that same gratitude that I was just mentioning a moment ago, because it has changed my life and so many people that I know, and just hope that that you find some value in it. But you bring a freshness, an enthusiasm, maybe a curiosity, and beginner's mind to the process. And those who've been practicing some time bring an experience, a depth of experience, and a groundedness to our community. So we're all creating a community here together to support each other. Bridget had mentioned about the silence and about that it might seem a bit strange and maybe antisocial or maybe something that might be daunting. Think of this as, at which it can be, the mind can easily go there. What am I getting myself into? Anyway, but think of this as a chance to make really good friends with yourself. That it's not so much that you are sacrificing or doing without, and as a kind of onerous assignment, but rather, oh, this is a chance in a very supportive environment for me to go inside, connect with this being right here, which ultimately I think is very good news. Sometimes there's an expression, oh, self-awareness is usually bad news, but actually deeper self-awareness is very good news when you see who you really are. And to access those places of kindness and wisdom and generosity of heart and compassion that are right there, if we learn how to more and more access it, are there for us, not just when the chips are down or when everything is going swimmingly, but can be here all the time. And it takes some practice to do that. But once you start to get the idea, there's nothing that you can do that I've seen as good for yourself as spending some time really connecting with who you are inside, whether it's in this style of meditation or in other ways where you turn the lens instead of going outward and feeling the connection that way, which can be a beautiful thing, but can also lead to a lot of distractions, to see that you can turn the lens inside, the awareness inside, and connect here, so that then when you connect with others, you're coming from a deeper, more connected place. So, Bridget had mentioned about keeping the silence. I'll just say a little bit. We'll go into a few more logistics in a little while, but I just want to mention now, as I think about it, while you're here, this is an opportunity to go inside. This is a non-residential retreat, so you'll be going home, many of you, to a household with other people, or you'll be interacting in your life with others. Don't feel you need to be silent for the weekend, unless you've got a very supportive environment where everybody around you is saying, oh, just let her be on her own or be quiet. And if you feel like doing that, fantastic. But, or if you, you can have your own space and not have many distractions, with others, then that's a, you know, a wonderful possibility. But when you're at home, you don't want to act so weird that people say, oh, what is he getting into now? So there'll be some, encouragement on how to take what we do here back home in your interactions with others and to just maybe be a little bit more conscious and kind and clear and use it as a little practicum for going home and just seeing how this can be really applied to your daily life. So I want to talk about a few things. First, about the retreat, the basic principles of the retreat, and then also specifically about this theme on awakening joy as the theme of the retreat, and then a little bit of a agreed upon guidelines for supporting each other here as we go through the weekend together, and then we'll take a little bit of a stretch and have some actual meditation tonight. Let's see. So if this is your very first experience with, say, a weekend of this sort before, just raise your hand. I'm curious. Okay. If you've done, say, one to three weekends before, raise your hand. Okay. And if you've done four or five or many, many, raise your hand. Okay. All right. So, good. Seasoned and new. Great. I'll be speaking particularly as far as the instructions go as if people are new. And for those who have heard them many times, you hopefully will have a beginner's mind and just hear it fresh. I'll try to be sensitive as much as possible to the fact that a number of people have done practice before and try to spend some time going over some basic things if there's a chance for people to who don't need to hear some of that. I'll see about acknowledging that, like with walking meditation or other things like that. So first, the basic idea of this meditation practice, mindfulness meditation practice, also called insight meditation or Vipassana meditation, is very simple, to just be here for your experience. This is where life is happening. And everything else is secondhand. As important as it is to plan for the future or learn our lessons from the past or to let the imagination go and have all kinds of creative thoughts, those are all wonderful and important parts of having this mind and this body. But if you're living your life in the future or in the past or in fantasy, if that's your main mode, which it is for most of us, most of the time, you're really missing out on your life. So this is something very radical, being present for your life. And the practice, the meditation practice, is really coming back to that basic idea of knowing what's happening right now. I'll mention a few aspects of this mindfulness practice so you get a little bit of a lay of the land. And now mindfulness has become so part of the mainstream cover of Time and Newsweek and in schools and in hospitals and in businesses and even in the military these days. Mindfulness, there's a mindfulness explosion over the last several years because there's been a lot of research that has shown how powerful it is, how impactful it is. And so what we used to do as a kind of almost, you know, counterculture thing 35, 40 years ago when I first was getting into it, is now seen to be a very respected and integral part of our culture and seen to be of benefit in so many different areas of body and mind health and awareness. But the essence is, one, seeing things as they are. I use the word vipassana, V-I-P-A-S-S-A-N-A. And that is a Sanskrit/Pali word that simply means to see things clearly, to see things as they are, which means you're not embellishing the experience, or you're not denying it, you're not pretending it's better than it is or making more of it than it is. You're just calling it like it is. You know, I grew up in New York City. I live out in California now, but in New York, it's very much a part of the culture to live in superlatives. Like, this is the most intense day of my life, you know. Even more than yesterday. Or, this is the greatest movie you'll ever see. Has anybody ever told you that? And you go to the movies and say, well, it was pretty good, but it wasn't the greatest. And it just even takes a little bit away. This is just calling it like it is. Just whatever is happening is happening. And so it's a great relief to realize you don't have to make anything special happen. Just knowing what's happening is good enough. In fact, is the idea, is the task. And if what's happening is a pleasant moment, it doesn't have to be off the charts, you know, bells and whistles. Oh my goodness, I'm going to get enlightened any moment. I can feel it. Just, this is really nice. Okay, fine. And if it's an unpleasant moment, I am bored out of my skull. If that bell doesn't ring in another 30 seconds, I'm going to just die. Oh, this is a bit boring. That's okay. So not to embellish it, make it more intense, just to call it like it is. Oh, this is what's happening now. Oh, breathing in, breathing out. That's what's happening. Hearing a sound. That's what's happening. Feeling this sensation. Feeling this mood. Knowing that thought is happening. Just what's happening. A second, I'll mention four different aspects of this mindfulness. A second thing that we'll be starting to learn more and more or practice more and more is being here in the here and now instead of the future or the past. So one is knowing what's happening, and two is having the intention to really be here. So whenever you're finding yourself lost in thought or some toppling forward to the future or the past. Oh, what's happening now? That's the essence of it. Because this is where life is happening. The third aspect, mentioned briefly, as you start to even try to pay attention to your present experience, after a while, you start to see for yourself the idea, the fact that everything is changing, that what was happening 10 minutes ago or yesterday has changed, or maybe even 30 seconds ago, it's changed, and what's happening now will change. Now, if you ask people, most people, do things change? Most will probably agree, yeah, things change. They do, sooner or later. But they don't live with that embodied understanding. So there we are, having a really difficult time in our life, and the mind can easily forget things change and think, oh my goodness, it's going to be, I'll never get out of this one. And get really unsettled and unnerved, forgetting that things change. And so if you see for yourself, and the meditation gives you a direct experience that things are changing continuously, then after a while, it does become an embodied perspective. And when the going gets rough, there's not this anxiety or fear that it's going to always last, but rather, oh, this is hard right now. What can I learn from it while it's here? Can I open up to it and learn to be with the difficult? And when things are going beautifully, often people forget that things change. And they can have that feeling, wow, I have worked really hard to get my life together, and finally I did. Great. Clear sailing out into the sunset, forgetting that things change. And when you see that they do, if you have some awareness, some embodied awareness of this fact, rather than scratching your head and saying, what did I do to blow it? Or if I were running the universe, I'd do a much better job than this. You realize, oh, when something is really great, don't miss it. Be here for it. And know that sooner or later, when it changes, it's not a mistake. It's just part of the rhythm of life. And the more you see for yourself that changing nature of experience, the more you realize you're not trying to get to any one final peak destination and somehow magically stay there. You're learning to be here for the ride of your life. You're learning to open up to the difficult stuff with grace and courage and trust, and you're learning to not take for granted the beautiful times and really to enjoy them fully, to savor them fully without holding on and grasping in fear that they'll go, because they will. And while you're holding on and grasping them, you're actually missing out on the richness of the pleasant. So this third aspect, seeing things clearly, being here in the present, realizing for yourself the changing nature of experience. And then the last aspect of this mindfulness practice is having a non-judging awareness. It's one thing to be aware in the moment, but often there's an editorial comment that goes along with it. This is good, I like this. This is bad, I don't like this. And if you can let go of thinking things should be a different way, if you can't do anything to change them, the judgment, which really, when I'm talking about judgment, a contracted mind that wishes things were different, is extra, and it creates a lot of inner turmoil and suffering. But to see clearly, oh, this is what's happening right now, it's like this, and to meet it with a wise response rather than a reaction of frustration or struggle, that is a huge understanding. Because then you can see what's here, see what needs to be attended to, and learn how to be with every part of that ride. So it's a non-judging awareness. Now, you might say, oh, then the idea is that I just notice what's happening, pay attention, and don't have any judgments about it. Good luck. The mind will most naturally have judgments galore and preferences. I like this, I don't like this, why is this happening, etc., etc. So it's not to get rid of the judgments, because they're just part of this mind that has preferences. But rather, and here's the secret, just learn to not judge them. Because you could say, okay, if I'm really doing this well, I won't have any judgments, and there you try to meditate and you realize, oh, I've just been sleeping for the last 10 minutes. Darn it. And then you realize, oh, that was a judgment. And then you hear your voice inside say, oh, that was another judgment. And you can put on one layer of judgment on top of another and judge the judging and judge the judging of the judging, etc., etc., an infinite regression. Until, and you don't have to go that far, you start realizing, oh, I can relate to that judging mind with great kindness. Oh, and there's judging in the mind. And as soon as you see it without judging it, you learn to be free of that reaction that usually grips us and brings about a lot of confusion and suffering and tightening of mind. As you do that, there's a number of benefits. One is you start to see an insight. This is sometimes called insight meditation. Unless you have a concern that you won't see any insights, you won't have any insights for the weekend, you'll probably very soon get in touch with the first and perhaps one of the most important insights that you can see. And that is, the mind is completely out of control. Now, you might say, gosh, that's depressing. Actually, it's great news. Why is it great news that your mind is out of control? Because then you don't have to blame yourself for what comes through it. All those thoughts that come through, those petty thoughts, those jealous thoughts, those wanting thoughts, those obsessive thoughts, those thoughts about the past or about the future, they're just coming and going. And if you realize the mind has a mind of its own and it's just doing its own thing, you don't have to blame yourself for it. You don't have to take them so seriously. It's not that you need to get rid of the thoughts. It's just to give them some space where you don't hop on the thought train with each one that comes by. Just imagine having any thought in the world, whatever thought perhaps has been troubling you, if there is one or more than one lately, and have it come through your mind and not be bothered by it. Oh, and there's that thought. Oh, and there's that scared thought or petty thought or lustful thought or whatever thought, and to see it with great kindness. Oh, and there's the mind doing its thing. No problem. This is tremendous freedom. So that's the first thing that you see. The mind is just this creative thinking machine. And what comes out in its own time. You don't have to get rid of the thoughts. Just learn not to get caught by them. Because when you do, then you can choose which thoughts to give energy to and which thoughts to let fly by. You have a bit more choice in that. Something else that comes from not jumping on the thought train is you see for yourself what it means to have a mind. In the teachings, these teachings that come out of the Buddhist tradition, the Buddha has one really pithy, simple teaching that has always had a big impact on me ever since I heard it. He said, in this fathom-long body that's 6 feet, give or take a foot and a half standard deviation or so, in this fathom-long body, the whole of life is revealed. This is the laboratory to understand the human experience. And the more you see this without taking it personally, the more you start to see how all of our minds operate with pretty much similar principles. The content is different from person to person, but there are certain principles that once you understand can lead to tremendous freedom. And by not taking it personally, seeing this as your laboratory that you've been issued to explore, then you move from, oh my goodness, look at my mind, which is not a whole lot of fun. Oh, look at this mom. Look at my mind. To, wow, look at the mind. Look at how the mind works. Without necessarily taking ownership of it. Oh, this is how the mind works. And that both gives you some real compassion for yourself and also a connection with everybody else. So when you see somebody going off and really lost, you can relate because you know what it's like to believe your thoughts. Oh, they've just gotten lost in their thoughts. And there's more of a sense of connection and compassion and understanding. The more you also learn to pay attention, the more life reveals itself to you. So there's a natural wisdom that starts to unfold that is transformative. And so this understanding is just seeing things with fresh eyes and understanding the magic of being alive. Understanding what it means to live really connected in this moment, because life keeps on revealing itself. And one more thing I'll mention before moving on, and that is the more you are able to become familiar with what it means, with that place that's beyond the chatter, that can be described as the still small voice within, in some traditions, or the kingdom of heaven within, or your higher self, or your Buddha nature, or whatever you call it. There is a place inside that's deeper than the confusion of chatter that we can connect with. It's a place of deep peace. It's your true home. And the more you become familiar and have access to it in the meditation, the more it becomes available to you in your life, not only when it's blissfully quiet, but even in the midst of challenges and difficulties and the frenetic pace of life. It's a little bit harder, but it can be practiced. And you start to become more familiar with what inner peace really is and that place of home. So those are just a few of the benefits of the practice, and we'll talk about more as we go through. Now, I just want to say a few words about this theme of awakening joy and how what we're doing here is really a path of happiness. And I'll be weaving in this perspective as we go through the weekend. When I first got into the meditation, it was a godsend. I had a lot of inner struggles. I didn't like myself very well. And when I found this practice, and this is back in the summer of 1974, in Naropa Institute, that first summer in Colorado, Boulder, Colorado. And I sat with my main teacher in this tradition named Joseph Goldstein, and he was saying it was possible to not be run by your neurotic thoughts. That had never occurred to me as an option before. I thought I was doomed to be just stuck in my mind. And when I first got into the practice, it was fantastic. And I felt like I had just come home. And I did a lot of practice those first years because I was so motivated because I had a lot of suffering. If you have a lot of suffering in your life and you're saying, I don't know if I'll be able to do this or if it'll work for me, you might be more motivated than the person next to you. I was very motivated and did a lot of practice, a lot of retreats because it was so compelling and I was learning so much and learning more and more to be kind to myself and see more clearly. And I had what is called a long honeymoon period where I fell in love with the practice, and this is the answer to everything for a while. And then, as I said, things change, and they did. And at some point, I became very serious about my practice. Dead serious about my practice. Emphasis on the dead. And I lost my joy. This is not something that was unique to me, but I misunderstood some teachings. And it's easy for, especially if you're getting into Buddhist philosophy, to forget that this is a practice of happiness. The Four Noble Truths, we won't get into them in depth this weekend, but if you're not familiar, the four truths are: there is suffering in life, there is a cause of suffering, there is an end to suffering, and there's a path leading to the end to suffering. That's a lot of suffering and emphasis on suffering. And it's sometimes easy to forget that this is about happiness. And the Buddha was called the happy one. The Dalai Lama, in his beautiful book, The Art of Happiness, which I highly recommend. The first line in that book is, the purpose of life is to be happy. The purpose of life is to be happy. Just let that land for a moment. The purpose of life is to be happy. Because if we find real happiness, then everybody gets the benefit of all the beautiful qualities that we've been gifted with. Then we're not playing small and thinking, oh, we don't deserve it, and I better not be too happy because others will think that I'm whatever. You can fill in the blank, or you feel guilty, or there's so much suffering. How can I let myself? If you find genuine well-being, then you radiate and awaken that in others. Just think of how it is to be around somebody who is not flaunting their happiness, but just quietly at ease and interested in you, and they're not judging you. You can feel relaxed and comfortable. And you want, as I wanted to when I first met Joseph, wanted to know, how is this person able to be so comfortable in their own skin? You know, or how is it that they can go through life even with their challenges and difficulties? And there are challenges and difficulties, first noble truth. They're suffering in life, but not be overwhelmed by them. And so, it can easily get lost in those teachings. And I think I'll just read one passage for those old practitioners to share, and with the new ones as well, the pitfall in getting very serious about practice. This is from one of the most respected monastics in this lineage of Buddhism called Theravada Buddhism, which is practiced in Southeast Asia and Burma and Thailand, Sri Lanka, etc. The earliest teachings of the Buddha, which is where this practice that we're going to share comes from. And his name is Ajahn Sumedho, just a really wise being. And this is what he says. Sometimes in Theravada Buddhism, one gets the impression that you shouldn't enjoy beauty. If you see a beautiful flower, you should contemplate its decay. Or if you see a beautiful woman, you should contemplate her as a rotting corpse. Now, this has a certain value on one level, but it's not a fixed position to take. It's not that we should feel compelled to reject beauty and dwell on its impermanence and on how it changes to being not so beautiful and then downright repulsive. That is a good reflection on what's called anicca, dukkha, and anatta, the impermanence of life, the unsatisfactoriness of life, and the selfless nature of reality. But it can leave the impression that beauty is only to be reflected on in terms of these three characteristics rather than in terms of the experience of beauty. People who can't see the beauty of the good or the true are really bitter and mean. They live in an ugly realm where there's no rejoicing in beauty and goodness and truth. But once you have true insight, then you find you enjoy and delight in the beauty and the goodness of things, because truth, beauty, and goodness delight us. In them we find joy. And this is from the Buddha, who says, this is in one translation of the Dhammapada, live in joy in love, even among those who hate. Live in joy, in health, even among the afflicted. Live in joy, in peace, even among the troubled. Look within, be still, free from fear and attachment, and know the sweet joy of the way. So anyway, I lost my joy for a while, and when I came back and realized that I'd gone astray somewhere, not conceptually, but in a deeper level, something had shifted in me. And when I came back and realized this is about realizing my full genuine nature, and my nature is to enjoy and celebrate the goodness of life as well as open up to the difficulties, I decided I wanted to take a look and see just what in these teachings point to real happiness. As the Buddha said, go for the highest happiness and all the other ones will follow. And what I found were some beautiful, beautiful teachings that point to genuine, deep happiness that one can practice and cultivate for oneself. And what I decided to do was, besides finding peace inside in the quiet of the meditation, to look at these different, what are called wholesome states, states of well-being, and see about cultivating them both for myself and sharing with others if they can be practiced in one's life besides informal meditation, and to see if they would have an effect. So what I did was take 10 different wholesome states and use certain principles that are there in the teachings and see about applying them so that one can cultivate more and more well-being. And I had my theories. I was going to try it out. I didn't know what was going to happen. Once I said, okay, let's practice this together with a couple of groups of people. This is back in 2003. And not surprisingly, but quite gratefully, lo and behold, when you practice them, they work. And from those small little groups of first two groups of 20, it kept on growing, and somehow people found them valuable, and out of that came both the book Awakening Joy and this course that Bridget mentioned that I teach, that people can take online, and people take them from all over the world. And I could never have figured this out, but it's just so still thrills me that more than 1,000 people usually take it each time. And if they practice it, it's good. So I wanted to share this as a theme as we go through the weekend and just give you a little taste of how you can apply some of these principles to one's life, in formal practice and in the practice, in daily life. So, I think I'll stop here right now and maybe leave you in suspense. And as we go through the practice through the weekend, just give you those principles and invite you to practice them as we're here together and then when you go home as well, and then for the rest of your life. So before I continue, just want to check anything that I've said so far that anybody has any comments or question about before we move to the next piece. Okay. Going once. Going twice. Yes.
How do you make happiness your greatest mission without turning it into a
Without what? How do you make happiness as your mission without turning into a goal? Well, the first, and we'll be going through this, we'll start tomorrow, but the first step of the 10 steps, and each one is a teaching from Buddhist philosophy, the first step is understanding how intention works. And intention is different from goal. They can support each other, but intention is a vision, an inspiring vision that you might have, that you're letting go of the timetable and the report card. There's no passing or failing this. There's only passing this. And you are simply inclining the mind with an inspiring vision and then getting clear on your decision to make this a priority, but letting go of attachment to the timetable. And we'll go into that more tomorrow. Anything else? Okay. I think before I, yes. Oh, I thought. Before I get into the next part, which will be the kind of creating of a space for our community and some guidelines that we can all share, how about if we just take a few minutes stretch? You've been listening patiently for a while. Let's take just 5 minutes and then come on back, okay? And right now, stay with the silence, okay? So now for the formal start of a retreat, I want to share with you something that I that we do on retreats traditionally, just to create a sense of community. And that will have us all in a as supportive an environment as possible. One has to do with taking what are called the three refuges, and another having to do about actions as we're here together, called the five precepts. As I'm sharing this, don't do anything that you're not comfortable with doing. But I think you'll probably see the, or understand the spirit behind these two. And, if there's any questions, then we'll take a moment to check in. So first, the three refuges in Buddhist thought are refuge in the Buddha, refuge in the Dharma, and refuge in the Sangha. And I'll explain what those words mean so that they'll make sense to you. And then if it feels right, you can join us. So the word Buddha both refers to the historical figure that lived in northern India 2,600 years ago, who touched something very profound that millions of people have been affected over the course of all of these centuries. And sometimes when people say, oh, I take refuge in the Buddha, they're feeling that inspiration from that that being. But there's a deeper level of what the word Buddha means. The word Buddha simply means awake, awakened one. And when you take refuge in the Buddha, you're taking refuge in your own capacity to awaken. not outside. The Buddha is no longer around. He solved his problem, and then he showed a way that we could understand what he understood. And so taking refuge in the Buddha, you might relate to it as taking refuge in that, or acknowledging that seed of wisdom that is right inside of you, as I said a little while ago, the same as the kingdom of heaven is within you, or that still small voice within, that you have been given this gift of life and everything you need to come to the deepest understanding and the full expression of your good heart. And when you take refuge in that, you see and are acknowledging, even if it's just conceptual, that you have this potential like everyone. And that what we're doing is just removing the obscurations from that divinity that's living right within you. So, taking refuge in the Buddha. The word Dharma, D-H-A-R-M-A, refers both to the body of teachings that came out of the Buddha, that figure, but more fundamentally, it refers to the natural law, the natural unfolding of life, the truth. There's a few different definitions. Sometimes Dharma can mean truth. Sometimes it can just refer to nature, the natural laws of life. And when you take refuge in the Dharma, you're taking refuge, you are opening up to the way things are, to reality. The Dharma is probably the closest word in Buddhism to the word God in more theistic religions. But it, rather than thinking of it as a creator being, it points to the mystery of things and to the perfection of life. In Judaism, the word God, I understand it as really the word is a placeholder for literally that which cannot be named, that it is beyond the human mind's comprehension to understand how this whole miraculous show is operating. And so taking refuge in the Dharma is to, on one level, take refuge in the truth of life as it's unfolding. Just as in the Christian tradition, one hears, not my will, but thy will. And there's a surrender to thinking that you can control things and really see what life is offering to you is just what you need to wake up in this moment. And when you take refuge in that, you are understanding that in the letting go of the control that you never had in the first place, there is a surrender, a beautiful surrender that that is in harmony with life. And so in that taking refuge in the Dharma, right here in this moment, what is life offering me to learn and wake up to? The word Sangha, taking refuge in the Sangha. Sangha both refers to those beings over time who've become enlightened or awakened, the community of those who've renounced the world for their own spiritual journey. But more fundamentally, Sangha refers to the community of like-minded friendship, that we can't do this alone. Rarely can we do this alone. We do this together. We support each other in our quest to understand. And when we forget, having good friends helps us remember, and we inspire each other. So, in this sense, taking refuge in this community is seeing we're all in this together. And everybody belongs, as I've said, and we can draw from everybody else's mutual commitment, and they can draw from our sincere sincerity of practice. So those are the three refuges. Any question on that? Okay, so I'll say these out loud, and you can just, if you like, take it quietly within yourself, and they can be really good resources, references, as you as we go through the weekend together. So, I take refuge in the Buddha, in that place inside of me that is already pure and free. I take refuge in the Dharma, in the way things are, the natural unfolding of life. I take refuge in the Sangha, the community of like-minded friendship that supports me and that I contribute to. Okay, and now having done that, I want to share with you these five guidelines for supportive community, known as the five precepts. And these are just guidelines to be to know that we can relax and be trusting and be at ease with each other. And these are given at the end, at the beginning of retreats that we do at Spirit Rock and other retreats, and are offered regularly to practitioners around the world. So the first precept, they all have to do with promoting a spirit of non-harming, because when we are not causing suffering to others, we can find a real peace inside. So the first precept is refraining from killing, which in a more positive way, to put it, to have a real respect and reverence for life. And while you're here for this weekend and at home, I would encourage you to maintain that precept. It's really a habit of happiness, so that we are offering the gift of non-harming to all beings, no matter what size or shape, that we are promoting a spirit of non-harming this time together. The second precept is to refrain from stealing, that is, from taking what is not yours. Just imagine what kind of a world this would be if we didn't need locks on the doors. We didn't need to look over our shoulder and wonder if our possessions will be there. It's a beautiful way to act in the community where everybody can be at ease and relax and trust that property will be respected. So refraining from stealing, more positively put, to have a spirit of generosity and respect with regard to others and other property. The third precept is refraining from causing harm through sexuality, which is such a cause of, can be a cause of real intimacy and connection, or can be a cause of real pain and exploitation, as we all know. And so this precept is having, again, a spirit of non-harming where we're not objectifying others, we're not trying to gratify our own senses for others at others' expense, and also turning our attention within so we are we're not focused on other. Now, if you are you have a partner and you're going home and it feels important to let that person know that you haven't joined a cult and you're still wanting to be affectionate or respond to their affection, then do as you see fit. But I would recommend, if possible, to just refrain from sexuality this weekend as a general guideline. And you, again, do as you see fit. Either way, this doesn't have to be a hard and fast rule in a non-residential retreat. But I would encourage the general principle of not causing harm through sexuality and not looking outside of ourselves for gratification where it's not within the confines of an ongoing relationship for this weekend. Fourth precept has to do with communication, and that is not causing harm through our communication while we're here. The noble silence is really a powerful support. Even if it doesn't seem like much, you whispering changes the container for everybody else. Unless, as Bridget said, it's to speak to one of the managers or question in the larger group or in the small groups or something that's absolutely needed to communicate. You know, if somebody has dropped their jacket, you know, it's fine to say, you know, you let them know, but not to engage unnecessarily so that other people can have their practice and you can have yours. At home, it's different. If you want to just be natural and conversing with those at home or those who you encounter for the weekend, just be mindful and don't cause harm through your speech. Basically, the guideline is saying what's truthful and what's useful. And then the last precept is about substances, and it is not causing, not taking substances which cloud the mind, which can include drugs or alcohol. Certainly if you're on medication, continue with your medication, but not to look for substances to for the benefit of greater pleasure. Coffee and tea is not included in this. So for those who are getting nervous that they have to withdraw from their morning hit or however, go right ahead. But otherwise, please refrain from substances while you're here on the weekend and going through the weekend. Okay, any question on that? Okay, so once again, I'll say them, and you can take them inside. For our time to together here, I undertake the training precept to refrain from killing, to express a spirit of harmlessness and respect life. For this time, I undertake the training precept to refrain from stealing, to respect property that is not mine. I undertake the training precept to refrain from causing harm through sexual relations. For this time, I undertake the training precept to honor the noble silence when we're here together and practice skillful speech outside of our time here together. And I undertake the training precept to refrain from intoxicants which cloud the mind during this weekend. Okay. So now in the last 15 minutes, we'll do a little bit of meditating together. And let me take a few moments to explain the meditation. We'll be going through a variety of instructions as we're here together. If anything is not clear at any time, please let me know so we can check in and make sure that you understand the basic instructions and approach. As I said early in the evening, the main idea is to know what's happening right now, to be present for your experience right now. And it starts traditionally the one place that many people find effective to rest in is knowing that you're breathing as you sit here. For some people, there might be better alternatives if you have some either problem with breathing as your main object, or it's there's some history around breath that makes it difficult. There are some other options, and we can explore that as well. But for most people, it's a very portable thing that you're always breathing, and it can always be it's one breath away, coming back to the moment. And we'll, over the course of the weekend, open up to include more and more of our experience, so that there's nothing that's left out of the meditation instructions, from sounds and sensations and feelings and even the thought process itself. But we just start with the most simple basic thing of sitting here knowing you're breathing. this is easier said than done. So I just want to share one very important piece that will save you a lot of hassle and make the meditation more user-friendly. The key moment in the meditation, as I see it, is the moment that you realize your mind has wandered. Your mind will likely wander. That's what minds do. If your mind doesn't wander, please come up and speak to me. I want to know what's going on in there. But for most people, you try to be here and goes off. When you realize that it's gone off, how you relate to that is key to the whole process. While it's gone, there's not much you can do about it. It is gone, right? You could be gone for 5 seconds. You can be gone for 5 minutes. You can be gone for 15 minutes. It's gone. And then at some point, and it helps to be in a room full of people, when it's gone, you might realize, oh, meditating, this is what we're supposed to be doing. One very common response to the fact that it's been gone is, oh, darn it, there I am wandering again. Get back here and do this right. You can perhaps hear the judgment and the frustration and the discouragement in that response. And what you are cultivating is judgment, frustration, discouragement, with a little bit of awareness thrown in. You don't want to be cultivating those things. So I don't recommend that as the response. A second very common response when you're lost in thought is, oh, I've been thinking, but this is a very interesting thought. Let me just go with this one. And when you've done it, you have bitten the bait and you are gone, if you're lucky, for 5 seconds, more likely a bit longer than that. So again, not the recommended response. It takes some resolve to not get seduced by your thoughts, no matter how wonderful or how troublesome they are. That's just another way. No, I don't want to think that. And then you are hooked on it. So the recommended response, which if you get will make a big difference, when you realize that you've been wandering, instead of feeling frustrated, appreciate the fact that you've just come back to the present moment. You're back here. Don't spend time beating yourself up over how long you've been away, because you'll have been away again while you're doing that. So appreciate, you don't have to throw a big party, but just realize, oh, back. And then let the return be done with great kindness and real patience and just sincerely begin again right now. The way you bring yourself back, or the way you come back to this moment, is the key. If you bring it back with patience and kindness and forgiveness and sincere intention to be here, that's what you're cultivating every encounter with the wandering mind. If you get that, everything else will follow. Okay? An image, one last thing, and then we'll actually be quiet together, is that you might find helpful that we've used for years, is training a cute puppy to stay on some paper. You know, you put it on, you don't want it running out into the street or jumping on people. You want it to stay when you say stay. So you put it on the paper. What happens? Wanders off. You bring it back. Stay. Come on. Stay. Bring it back. If each time you bring it back in that loving, firm, caring way, after a while, it starts to get it. Think of your mind as this cute, frisky, energetic puppy dog that doesn't know any better, wanders off, is back in junior high with your first crush. Oh, come on back. Come on back to the moment, okay? Wanders off again. What am I going to do when I grow up, no matter how old you are? Come on back, stay. And in that way, you're training not only your mind to stay in the moment, but to have a very healthy, wise relationship with the mind. So keeping that in mind, we just have a few minutes. I invite you to go inside, and tomorrow we'll talk more about posture. For now, just find a posture you can be reasonably upright and still. You might take a few deeper breaths and breathe in a calming energy. And as you breathe out, let go. And then let the breath find its own natural rhythm. Notice where you feel the breath most clearly. How do you know you're breathing? Maybe as the breath enters the nostrils, or maybe the belly or the chest rising and falling, maybe your whole body expanding and contracting. Just how do you know you're breathing? Wherever you're drawn to, let that be your home base for now. Just knowing that you're sitting here breathing, and as I said, each time you notice the mind wander, just bring it back quite lovingly and begin again. when the bell rings, notice the experience of hearing. And when you're ready to change posture or open your eyes, let it be a very gentle, mindful transition coming out of the stillness. The other important moment besides the wandering is when the meditation ends. Just notice if you have any kind of evaluation of how you did. Like, oh gosh, I was just so spaced out. Or, hey, I think I'm a natural at this. Pretty good, you know. Notice it. Don't believe it. Just whatever happened was just fine. You put in your time, you showed up, and let go of the report card. So we'll be doing a lot more of that tomorrow. I'll be talking a lot less than tonight, don't worry. And it's going to be really a treat to go through this with you tomorrow. And I would encourage you, just as a little extra credit assignment when you're home, something radical, especially for somebody from New York who's a very accomplished multitasker, unitasking, that's your assignment. Try to do one thing at a time, if you can. And when you're brushing your teeth, just brush your teeth. When you're sipping your cup of tea, just sip your cup of tea. When you're with somebody and talking, just be with them. Notice what it's like to be present for your life. And when you realize your mind has spaced out and you're off somewhere, come on back, just like with the meditation, and come on back very gently, lovingly. Keep your sense of humor. Make it a game. Make it playful. And you can see this is not just for when you're in the quiet meditation. This is about anything that you do.